Hello and welcome to this podcast from the IASB. My name is Robert Bruce and I am a financial journalist. With me to discuss the board meeting of the 18th to the 21st of January 2011 are board member Stephen Cooper and Alan Teixeira, Director of Technical Activities. A relatively short number of topics to discuss today. Can we start? Alan, would you talk us through what happened on revenue recognition?
Well, thanks, Robert. It's revenue recognition. It's one of our major joint projects with the FASB. And of course, the FASB was across here this week with us for 3 days. We had a couple of sessions on the 19th and 20th of January to discuss revenue recognition. Not a lot of decision making at this stage because it's the early part of re-deliberation. Essentially, we've been through comment letter a summary last December. We received almost 1,000 comment letters in here. Having got a flavour of where we are, we're now going into much more detailed analysis. And one of the first issues we looked at was segmenting a contract, and that is when you've got one contract which essentially has two or more contracts embedded in or components of it in a sense. I think the way that the document was drafted, there was a perception that you needed to basically segment this contract down into smaller and smaller parts, and people were troubled that this was quite burdensome. And I think that one of the themes you'll start to see over the coming months is a lot of the feedback we've received and the thinking that's been going on amongst the staff building up to these re-deliberations. We're going to see a lot more simplification of the requirements. They'll be far more practical, easier to apply. So first thing the boards did was decide to eliminate the requirement in the new IFRS that we were proposing to account for one contract as two or more, where the goods or service in the contract have got interdependent pricing. So we're relaxing that a lot more, and it's basically bringing these together so you account for these as one combined contract.
Yeah.
The rest of the discussion that we had over the last couple of days has focused a lot on determining what the transfer of goods and services is. Now, just to recap, the core principle in the exposure draft is that you recognise revenue in a contract with a customer, basically as you transfer the goods or services to that customer, so as control transfers. Now, for a lot of goods, that's quite easy to see. The difficulty is identifying when the transfer is with a service, and in fact sometimes even defining what a service actually is. And so we spent quite a bit of time discussing how to distinguish between a service and a good, and also what transfer of service is. And one of the examples that does keep popping up, it's almost like our little, I guess our case study is an audit opinion, because most of the time when you do have a service, for example, somebody comes you've got a service, they're going to mow your lawns every 2 weeks, for example, you can see the person coming to mow your lawns. Mm-hmm. But take something like an audit opinion. What will often happen is that the auditors will come along in the interim phase, they'll do some systems work, some checks and things like that, and they might continue to come backwards and forwards, but really the only thing that matters at the end is the audit opinion itself. And sometimes auditors get fired, or sometimes auditors find that they have a conflict of interest for some reason, mm-hmm. And actually have to withdraw from the audit. Somebody has to come in and take over. But in a lot of these cases, they will still be remunerated for the work that they've done today, even though they actually haven't delivered anything, theoretically, until the very end. And so we're trying to develop principles that would mean that we get sensible outcomes. And, the two extremes in this, you should, as an audit firm, be able to recognise some of your revenue as you perform the audit, even the interim phases, or should you wait until the very end? And we could develop a principle that maybe people were comfortable that was only at the end for an audit, but you then overlay that over other types of contracts and people saying, well, you know what, that means you don't get any revenue to deliver something like, a report that you're doing for somebody, consulting report, or, somebody's architect's plans for a house, and you wait until the very end of that. So I think that's where the discussion's going at the moment, and there's some proposals that will... I think one of the interesting things is there's some proposals in terms of our definition of a service that are going to be very helpful, because a lot of people saw the way that the document was drafted that most of the transfers were not services but were actually goods, and probably the classic of that is in the construction industry. When you, for example, have a builder doing some work on a house, people were very worried that the builder would never be able to recognise revenue until the very end. But in fact, if it's a service and they're delivering, and we're looking at characteristics and indicators that suggest that the customer's receiving a service as opposed to actually buying a good. Little things, Steve, like, you know, I think one of the things we looked at was if the work in progress is actually controlled by the customer. And so you'd imagine, you know, you're putting a new roof on your house. Presumably you control the house, and as the tiles get put on, you've got a sense that you can actually control that work in progress as it's going along.
Yeah, well, we ended up with three tentative criteria for a service, and control of the work in progress is another, and two others which I'm not going to read out because they're fairly lengthy, but people can have a look at the official update to see where we got to. And as Alan says, this, I think, we're trying to clarify what a service is. I think this widens the scope of service somewhat to ensure that we try and get the right things in there. Of course, that doesn't then deal with how revenue is recognised and whether it's an input approach or an output approach in terms of then recognising the revenue over the period that the service is provided. And that's something that we will have to come back to. But the whole distinction between goods and services are very important. Actually, in some respects, the terminology is not really appropriate, because it is more discrete delivery and continuous delivery rather than goods and services. And sometimes I think the terminology gets in the way.
Yeah, I think some people feel a bit troubled by this notion that you transfer a service to somebody. Basically, somebody benefits from the service, or they've got the benefit or consumed it, but you know, the notion of transferring a service or the control over a service doesn't feel quite right.
But I think we made some good progress. We didn't really take any firm decisions on it, but I think we, based upon the comment letters and the feedback, we knew the direction we need to go in, and it's just a question of finding the right words for it.
That discussion and the debate will continue on the 1st and 2nd of February. This is the next slot we have for RevRec.
In that case, let's turn to leases. Steve, what happened?
Well, this was the first session that we've had since the close of the comment letter deadline. So the staff gave us a very detailed summary of what we have learned from the comment letters, but also from the outreach. And in fact, they gave a description of the very large number of meetings and other events that we've held, talking to a very wide range of constituents. I think the comment letters were over 700, so we've had some very good and useful feedback on this. So necessarily, the comment letter summary was also pretty detailed. I think it was 70 or 80 pages of it in the end. So again, I'm not going to try and summarise that. Many people listening to this will know the contentious areas, which of course have been highlighted, the lessor accounting issue, contingent rents, optional lease periods, definition of a lease. These issues, we've mentioned them in these podcasts, and they've been very well debated in these different outreach activities. So anybody interested can go onto the website and find that comment letter summary. Of course, it is a summary, in spite of being fairly long, and we will be looking in more detail at specific issues as we go along. And Alan, we have a new internal database, I know, to help us do that more detailed interrogation of comment letters, and that's now fully up and running.
Yeah, one of the concerns that a lot of people seem to express to us is that 760 or so letters on leases, nearly 1,000 on revenue recognition, 200 and something on insurance, but some of those are very long and detailed. And you say, well, how can you actually analyse those, read all those letters, think about them, and give them the due consideration that they actually deserve? Steve said we do that in two ways, in a sense, in that he's mentioned the comment letter summaries, and they're very important for us. That's a broad, I won't say shallow analysis, it's much broader analysis. Yeah. They're generated by having the project teams read every letter, and what they do is they get a flavour for what people have said. And you also, if you read all the letters, because a lot of the themes are very consistent, you get a real sense for which ones are most troubling to people or controversial, and which ones are, you know, there's a little bit of drafting advice in there for some, in some cases, and just that people raise a few little questions on something on transition, for example. So those comment letter summaries we place on the website, they just set the tone. And by the way, we do that pretty quickly as well. Normally within 4 to 6 weeks of the comment period closing, yep. our staff will have read every letter and generated the summary. We don't make any decisions at the board when we do that. That's really, it helps set up the re-deliberation plan because it identifies which things we need to do earlier in the process. Now, when I get down to the detailed analysis, this is where our database is very helpful. We've taken every single letter, and we have our technical staff, because we need the technical experts to do this, sit there and they code up the letters and they identify characteristics of the sender themselves. So we can tell you how many people were from particular geographical regions, the demographics, are they a user or a preparer? If they're an analyst, for example, what sector are they in? The same with preparers. So think about revenue recognition, identifying construction contract people, the telecommunications. They're two of the controversial yep. areas. Yep. So we can pull out all those letters electronically and actually look at those. And as I said, 100% of every letter is coded and put in there. So we can generate reports, or at least to help us identify those letters and remember where comments came from. If I said, right, I actually need to find out what everybody in the telecommunications sector said about a particular issue, I can pull that data out in a report so I can see who said what and why. I had them sorted by those who were very much in favour, those who had expressed qualified support, those who were very much against it. I can then identify geographical differences. Is it users, preparers? Is there conflict? You know, it's great when we find users and preparers actually agree on something. And we can use this tool to do that. So, you know, the good thing is, I think the message I would give is that we've got real confidence that we can actually, one is that all these letters are read, that they're analysed, they're thought through carefully, and they're given as much consideration as they deserve, and we, despite the fact that they are large in volume.
Yeah, we've been using this for a little while now, and the pensions ED, I think, was one of the first ones, middle of last year, we did it on. And I must admit, it proved extremely valuable in really analysing in more detail some of the issues that the comment letters had raised. So as I said, we spent a fair bit of time talking about the general responses to the leasing exposure draft. We also then spent some time looking at lessor accounting. We realised that this is going to be a challenging area. Mm-hmm. So we did decide that we are going to continue with lessor accounting at the same time as lessee, particularly as regards the controversial areas, because we feel that discussing them together will be much more informative. However, we didn't make any definitive decisions about exactly what we're going to do with lessor accounting. Various ideas were floated at the meeting, ways in which we might be able to move it forward. As I'm sure people are aware, that the two boards have had a difference of opinion about lessor accounting in terms of the methodology. We managed to come up to a converged solution in the end, but you know, there are still differences of opinion amongst the two boards. So we was trying to explore, in the light of the comments we've received, ways forward. And I have to say, we made some good progress on that, and I think the staff were very pleased with the direction that we gave to them.
Good. In that case, on to the next topic, Alan, post-employment benefits.
Yeah, this is ISB only part of the meeting that was discussed. It was the last item we had on the agenda for this meeting. And there are just two issues in there. One was the presentation of the remeasurement component, and the other was to deal with settlements and curtailments. I want to focus mainly on the presentation of the measurement component, because this was an area where the board's revisited. Late last year, the board made a decision that essentially there'd be an optional free choice, and that you could present the remeasurement component of the pension in either profit or loss or OCI. And in the comment letters, I think that there's quite strong support for it being presented in OCI. But one of the difficulties is that sometimes there is you introduce an accounting mismatch by doing so, and quite a fundamental one. Usually when people have got assets that they're holding themselves that are designed to meet those obligations, so we're actually putting the asset side through P&L, but the liability side through OCI. So the board had a look at this again, and essentially it's moved away from giving a straight free choice, and the default is that you need to present this as part of OCI or other comprehensive income. And what we're doing now is we're just looking at the wording to, we don't want this to be a free choice. We're trying to constrain the ability to put this back up into profit or loss, in a way that's sensible, because as I said, you know, it's major mismatches that we're trying to deal with, and we've got to be very careful about the constraints we put on this. Once you make the election, should it be revocable, for example? So we're having a look at the wording to make sure that the board's comfortable with that.
Good. Finally, I guess, insurance. Where are we on insurance?
Well, I guess we're at a similar place as leasing. We had another detailed comment letter analysis. Again, issues to do with insurance, I guess, are fairly familiar. Discount rate, risk margin versus composite margin, a range of other issues that have come out from our outreach and also the comment letter process. I mentioned discount rate as being one of those key issues. What we did do is to have a separate session where we invited three parties to come in to talk to us about how they would deal with the discount rate issue. Now, these three were all parties that have advocated some sort of rate based upon an observed rate of return on assets. The methodology that we had in the exposure draft was a risk-free rate plus an illiquidity premium. There are some that supported that. Many, however, said the illiquidity premium was too difficult to calculate. A number of respondents said we shouldn't go for that, either for conceptual or practical reasons, and we should instead focus upon the return on the assets. Return on assets has a particular advantage in that it gets a credit spread in the discount rate, and that credit spread, of course, affects the value of the related assets. If we include it in the discount rate, then we have more of a match between the assets and liabilities. So we have to think about the practical issues, we have to think about the conceptual issues, but what we wanted to do is to invite three parties in that have advocated different versions of this to tell us exactly how they would do it. So we had Rob Essen there from the National Association of Insurance Commissioners in the States. They have a particular approach called an economic default adjusted discount rate, and Rob went through the methodology for that. We also invited somebody from Canada to talk specifically about the Canadian approach, which is an asset-linked discount rate. And then we also had two people from Deloitte to come and tell us about how they would do it based upon a reference asset portfolio. Now, there were similarities between all of them. They weren't taking the expected asset return, but they were modifying that, generally taking out the expected credit losses, but modifying it in other respects as well. There were differences whether it was a reference portfolio or the actual asset portfolio. So the board had presentations from the three. We had quite a lengthy discussion. We've also asked them to go away and do some additional work, in particular to come back with some numbers to show us exactly how it would be applied. So that'll be an important part of our deliberations. It certainly isn't the end of our discussions on that issue. Yeah. We'll debate more the conceptual aspects of it. We'll revisit the practical elements. We have to talk about it in the context of volatility and presentation, because there are a number of areas that interact that we need to think about. But I think people were quite pleased with the way the session went and what we learned from it.
Good. Before we wrap everything up in that case, what's happening next week? More board meetings next week?
Yeah, well, it's actually, you know, Steve said, I think it's been a pretty positive week on all the projects. We've made pretty good progress, actually, and we really need to keep the momentum going. And you'll see coming up next week, when on Wednesday the 26th of January, we have another joint board meeting. My recollection is it's 1 p.m. till 3 p.m. GMT. People should look on the website just to confirm those hours, because we have so many meetings often, I forget the actual specifics, but I'm pretty sure it's 1 till 3 on Wednesday the 26th. We'll be looking at leasing again, and that's the definition of a lease once more. We have another joint meeting with the FASB on the 1st and 2nd of February. Some of it will be joint, some ISB only. We're looking at insurance, post-employment benefits, revenue and leases. And I think one of our first cross-cutting papers will come back. We're going to be looking at probability-weighted measures and how we use that across the projects. Mm-hmm. So there's quite a bit of activity in terms of meetings. And a couple of due process documents coming out soon. On Friday the 28th of January, we expect to publish an exposure draft on offsetting or netting. We're joining with the FASB where we've got a potential approach that would be a converged solution for presenting financial assets and liabilities on the balance sheet. And then the following Monday, that's the 31st of January, we expect to publish a supplement to our November 2009 exposure draft on impairment. And that's where, again, this is joined with the FASB. We've got a model in there, although it wasn't the preferred model of either board. It presents a model that would get us to a converged solution.
Excellent.
That's it.
Okay. Thank you very much indeed, Alan. Thank you very much, Steve. Now, for the final disclaimer, the views expressed in this podcast are those of the individuals concerned and are not necessarily those of the IASB. For the official record of the meeting, please go to the IASB website. Thank you. Goodbye.